but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
I'm a curious person. I love to interview other people. I love to ask questions. I don't care if you're a sports person or not, but I love to get to know people a little bit. Part of the fun of this show for me is when we have guests on. We've had them on over the years. They don't even have to have like a sports background. John Lovitz was on the show years ago. I watched an interview that I did with Lovitz in studio on the YouTube channel, and I left it going, man, that was a fun talk. I need to do that more often. Have the comedians on. Norm MacDonald, Chris Farley's brother came in studio one time. David Spade on the show. Howie Mandel on the show. And one of the things I geek out on is just kind of interviewing people. And you know it if you hear the interviews on this show. I talked to Dan Lanning, and we talked about Dan Lanning's family and the Outback Steakhouse last time he was on. We get to know him and his family and the person that is on the sideline at Oregon as much as we get to know what's actually going on in the games. And so one of the things we did years ago on the show is we created a segment that was called Johnny on the Spot. Me being Johnny, me being on the spot being the point of the segment, because I'm the one that asks the questions all the time. And the reason I'm bringing this up, the whole reason I'm bringing this up, is Trent Walker, Oregon State wide receiver. I was texting with Trent Walker today, the Oregon State wide receiver, who's coming on the show here in about 20 minutes. And I texted with him, and he said, John, I have a question for you today. He's going to turn the tables on me. Like, Dan Lanning's done that a couple times. He goes, hey, I got a question for you. And he asks a question because, it's not fair that I get to be the only one peppering people with questions. But I said to Trent Walker, okay, I'm not even going to ask you what the question's about. I'm just going to wait and hear what Trent Walker wants to ask me at 3:24. So he's got a question for me, Stephen, that he's going to pepper me with. And it got me thinking about that segment we used to do, Johnny on the Spot. And it was a segment I got very nervous about doing because it put me in a position that I was not used to being in that people were peppering me with questions. And, and some of it had to do with sports, but some of it had to do with the job. Some of it had to do with my habits. Some of it had to do with my philosophy on life. Some of it had to do with, whether or not I have ever changed my oil on my car. Some of it had to, people wanted to know is, do you think a grilled cheese sandwich is underrated or overrated? There are a lot of things that are underrated in the world, but I'm not sure the grilled cheese sandwich is on that list. 503-417-7575 is the number. We got a great show today. The Blue Jays in the driver's seat in the World Series. Oregon State and Washington State preparing for a football game on Saturday. It'll be the first of a home-and-home series with the Cougars and the Beavers. We'll talk about that game. I will interview Trent Walker, the Oregon State wide receiver. I guess he's going to ask me a question as well that he's got for me. I wonder what it is. That interview, part of our tribute to Jamba on this show, because life is better blended. You know that. And so Trent Walker will be joining us. Steven's got the 5 at 5. We're going to lead you right into a fascinating football game, intriguing football game, Ravens-Dolphins Thursday night football. We will talk about the college football playoff rankings that are going to be coming out next Tuesday. I have a lot of thoughts about that. We're going to go through some of the big games of the weekend. Ducks are idle. There'll be a bye week for the Oregon Ducks this weekend, but Oregon State's playing an important game, and we have a lot to talk about. But before we do all that, Trent Walker should not be the only person who gets to ask a question. So if you have a question for me, it can be sports-related or not, 503-417-7575 is the phone number. It's a burning question on your mind, something you're curious about, something you want to know. I am here for you. I will answer your questions. Stephen Vaughn, Trent Walker wants to ask me a question. I'm intrigued at what he's going to ask me.
I am too, because I have no idea where it's going to go. Like, I assume it's going to be about sports, but you don't know that, right? Like, it could be anything. And Trent Walker's talked about stuff like off the field. So I can't wait to hear what Trent Walker has up his sleeve for you, John, because when Lanning does it, I'm pretty sure it's not going to be about like sports. It's going to be something personal, because Lanning likes to go, you know, a little bit personal. He likes to talk about his family on the show and stuff like that. So I don't know where Trent Walker's going to go with it, but I can't wait.
Yeah, let's see what he does. Do you have a question for me? Like, he shouldn't be the only one. Is there anything you've ever wanted to ask me? And it could be mundane. It could be something serious. I'll offer it to listeners as well. 503-417-7575. You interview me. What do you want to know? Put me on the spot. Stephen, what do you want to know?
You know, this wasn't like a personal question I've always needed to ask you, but I do like this question. And I was asked this question in sixth grade. As an athlete, what is the one play that is like the most exciting play or the most satisfying play an athlete can have in any sport? Is it like a slam dunk? Is it a home run? Is it throwing a long touchdown pass? Is it breaking off a long touchdown run? What play, what one particular play is the most satisfying for an athlete in your opinion?
I can tell you this, from my own personal experience, okay, playing baseball, playing football, I played both in college at some level. Small college, Division II baseball. I was a community college wide receiver and punt returner. And I can tell you that the two things that popped into my mind, first of all, was being a guy who played baseball through college, there is nothing that feels better than hitting a baseball squarely. And there's
That's
no
the correct answer, by the way.
There's no feeling to it. It just... When you hit the ball and you hit it on the button and it, you know, you've hit not on the button, your timing's right and you got all of it. It doesn't feel like anything coming off the bat. It feels like it's just effortless coming off the bat. And there's no other way to describe it. I've heard golfers talk about that. I haven't experienced that as a golfer though. Maybe my golf swing's not as good. Like, I've heard golfers say that, yeah, it's effortless like that. But in baseball, people would be like, what did that feel like? And the answer is, it felt like nothing, and that felt good. The second thing that I thought about was, you know, I was a good high school wide receiver. I caught like 50 or 60 passes my senior year of high school. I made the section all-star game, whatever. And there's something about being under the lights in a high school football setting. I can't imagine what it's like in a major college setting, because and I'll ask Trent Walker this coming up, like, the ball being in the air when you know you've got a defensive back beat, the quiet that you hear, there's no crowd noise, there's nothing, the ball's in the air, all you can see is the football, and you know that when you catch it, you're going to have nothing between you and the end zone. There is a stillness to that moment that is a lot like hitting the baseball on the button and feeling nothing. I think those two things, and I'll tell you what the most terrifying thing is, because it goes along with lines of that, because I returned punts in junior college in California. Like, I played in a good conference that had schools like San Francisco City College and De Anza and Foothill. Like, it was high-level community college football. Like, a lot of those guys went on and played places. I was a punt returner and a wide receiver on my team. And they put me back there as a punt returner, not because I was like a game-breaking threat to score a touchdown every time. They put me back there because they trusted me. They put me back there because they knew I would catch everything. And it's a lot probably like what Trent Walker goes through at Oregon State when they put him back there as a punt returner, because they're going, who do we trust back there? And when you are punted the ball, there is a stillness and a quiet that exists as the ball is in the air coming down towards you. And yet you can hear the footsteps of people rumbling towards you that want to knock your block off. It is, I think it's one of the most terrifying things in sports. It's the equivalent of when you go on YouTube or you go on TikTok and you see those people who are on that rubber band like amusement park ride where they lose consciousness. And they're flying, you know, they're flying every which direction. I can only imagine that's what it's like, because I think I asked Trent Walker this the last time he was on, like, do you hear the noise? And he goes, oh yeah, they're talking to you all the way down. But you've got to concentrate on that ball, because you know, if you catch the ball cleanly, the officials are supposed to allow, you know, you're not supposed to get a cheap shot in that situation. So you almost have to say, my job is to catch the ball and ignore everything else that is happening. Ignore all the other stimuli that is coming my way. Ignore the footsteps. Ignore the words that are being uttered as people are screaming, running towards you. Ignore everything else and just catch that ball. 503-417-7575. You get to interview me. Ask me a question. Put me on the spot. Ask me what my favorite stadium is to visit. Ask me what my favorite sport is to cover. Whatever it is that you are curious about, I will field your question because Trent Walker is coming on the show and he says he has a question for me. We'll see what Trent Walker has for me coming up here, top of the hour. Meantime, Blue Jays grabbing command of this best of seven series, this World Series with the Dodgers. Holy hell. Blue Jays threatening the Cinderella story that is the Los Angeles Dodgers. Threatening all of Southern California, threatening this America versus Canada battle that we have going on. It's true, we took hockey from them. It's true, we stole people like Conan O'Brien from them. It's true that maple syrup, it might be theirs, but we probably do it as well as anybody. They're about to take our pastime from us and claim stake to the World Series. Is the best baseball team in the world located in Canada? I shudder at the thought, but it's kind of what the Toronto Blue Jays are suggesting. They are up 3-2 in this best of seven series. The series is heading back to Toronto. The Dodgers, they don't need to win two in a row. No. That's the wrong way to think about it. I know what you're thinking. Oh, they have to win two. They don't have to win two in a row. They got to win one or it's over. So if you're the Dodgers, that's what you're going to hear them talking about. Hey, it's a one-game series, and then it's a one-game series. 503-417-7575. Want your questions. Let's go to Aaron, who's in Gresham. Aaron, go ahead. Keep it clean.
Hello, John. Thank you. Will disc golf, professional disc golf, will that ever be taken seriously enough that people outside of the sport know who the disc golfers are? And the reason I ask is because there's a kid right now at Dallas. I mean, at Gresham High School, Dallas Garber. He's getting ready to go pro. He's going to be on tour next year, and he's going to make some pretty serious noise. Is anyone going to hear about it? Thank you.
All right, that's a great question. All right, so here's the thing. As you said that, I started shaking my head going, no, this isn't going to become mainstream. It's not going to become a household name. But I think in the same way that you see somebody locally who makes it to like the last round of The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, or somebody who gets to the finals of American Ninja Warrior or wins one of the seasons on American Ninja Warrior or gets on Jeopardy and wins a Jeopardy round. In that kind of context, I think you'll see somebody who goes to the highest levels of a sport like disc golf, but it's not going to be mainstream. There isn't bandwidth. There isn't the television contracts that exist in the other sports. It's not quite enough to elevate it to the stratosphere of household name and he walks into a restaurant, he's going to get the best table. It's not going to happen. I think one of the things you see happening with the NBA, Major League Baseball, the NFL, the mainstream big sports, is you see them eating up more and more of the bandwidth. The NFL is expanding their season. They've already expanded their offseason. They're a year-round thing. The NBA tries to do the same thing. College football now saying, okay, we want a longer season, more playoff games. What are they talking about? Moving the season forward. Major League Baseball adding rounds to the playoff. Get rid of the one-game winner-take-all series. What? Add more wild-card series. Why? Because it's more valuable. They're trading one game for a five-game series at the end of the season. And so I don't think there's room. There's not bandwidth. There's no room in the sports ecosystem for the fringe sports, and that's what disc golf is. And, you know, I put it in there, you know, along with some of the other fighting, in addition to kind of the combat sports that are out there fighting for real estate, in addition to the Olympics that come around every 4 years or 2 years, winter and summer, in addition to track and field trying to, you know, say, hey, how do we make our sport more popular, more TV friendly, in addition to all the soccer we're seeing out there and all the other sports that are getting dreamed up. So I don't see it happening at all, but doesn't make it a bad thing. Like, you know, we had a kid on the show that got to the final round of American Ninja Warrior before, and I thought it was a cool interview, and we had him on. So, and then we had one of the Bachelor finalists I think it was Lauren. Was Lauren the bachelor? Lauren, the kid, she was from West Lynn. We had her on the show. It was a big deal. And we would bring Jesse Palmer on. You know, we're talking a little football when we talk about his TV show. So I still think it's a big deal. 503-417-7575. Pepper me with questions. Do you have a question for me? Steven, do you have another question for me? I'm going to let you go either one.
Do you make your kids bring the garbage cans like to the end of the seat?
Oh, my goodness. You're hitting on a sore subject for me. I hate to bring my frustrations into this radio show, my home frustrations. This came up last night. This is a doozy. I want you to tell me, am I a bad person for this going down? I noted I'm the trash person. I'm the trash can person, in part because the trash cans have to go up a hill and they go about, you know, 50 or 70 yards up this hill and then down the hill. And I've never felt like the kids taking the trash cans that are full up and down that hill is necessarily what I want. And you know what? I can do it. I'm a grown up. You know, this is one of my chores. I noticed the other day, though, because our garbage day is Tuesday night. I noticed on Tuesday as I came up the driveway that the cans were already out. And I thought that that was an odd thing, the cans being out. I also noticed that the cans weren't in the normal place that I put them. Now, I assumed incorrectly that maybe one of the kids or Anna put the cans out. Turns out it's not true. My sister put the cans out. She's trying to do a nice thing. She's trying to, you know, put the cans out and do a nice thing. But she put them in the wrong spot. And anybody knows who's got neighbors in close proximity, we've got a bunch of neighbors who all kind of put their trash cans in one place. So last night when I went to go take the trash cans down, I found that only one of the trash cans was brought down. And I said to myself, like, what happened here? Why is only one of the two cans down? And oh, by the way, where's the other can? So I went back up to where the cans are, and I found this match game going on where all the trash cans were kind of mixed together. And I had to sit there on my phone because I took a picture of the trash cans months ago and figure out which trash cans were ours before I could bring it down. It took me about 15 minutes to figure out which trash can was ours. And so I, Steven, tell me if I'm horrible for saying this. I literally want to tell my sister, don't help with the trash cans. I don't need the help because it caused about a 15 minute frustration instead of you actually helping. Now I know her heart is in the right place. And I know that,
it probably sounds terrible,
but I'm the king of garbage and I need to be the king of garbage. How about that? How about that?
It doesn't make you a bad person, but I will say as long as you are giving the kids other chores to do, I think that's okay.
Yeah. Oh, they're not getting away with
it. Okay. Well, good then. That's the mostly thing.
Let's go to Dan, who's called in. Dan, what's up, man?
Hey, guys. Do you think it's unethical for me, because I don't have a gym membership at the moment, to hop around from gym to gym and take free trials? And I'll tell you, I'm on my way to my fifth free trial. Love you, boys.
I love it. He's going to take a free trial at a gym. Is it unethical? No. I mean, I think you're playing within the rules. The spirit of the game is fine. But yeah, I don't think you're any different than people that go into Costco and just walk around for the samples. If they're giving them out, that's their loophole to close. That's what I'm going to say on that front. Let's go to Matt, who's in Savvy Island. Matt, go ahead. What's up, man?
I heard a hot take on sports radio today about the North Texas football coach. And I was just wondering if you know anything about him, Eric Morris.
Yeah, I do know. I know a little bit about him. Yeah,
and that he was not ready for a premier program yet, but for Oregon State and his development of quarterbacks and all that, and if he's on their radar at all.
Yeah, it's a good question. So Matt Morris was at Washington State, and was the coordinator there, and he also if you think about him. He's a guy that is sitting in a position at North Texas that is at a middle of the pack at best job sitting at that school. But you're talking about Eric Morris. But he, he's at North Texas, previously was at Washington State. I think he can do better. than Oregon State. I think he will have better opportunities than Oregon State. I think in his heart, he probably would look at moving from North Texas to Oregon State as it might be a small step up. But remember, he came to Washington State from Incarnate Word, where he was Cam Ward's offensive coordinator. He went to Washington State, and then when Cam Ward left, he said, okay, I'm going to North Texas, and Cam Ward went to Miami. If you look back, he's born in Texas. He played at Texas Tech as a player in college. I don't think he would be interested in coming back to the Pacific Northwest, and I think he could do better. But I like that you're thinking in those terms, because it is the kind of coach where you go, okay, wait, he's got some upside. Would he be interested? Now, if he was an Oregon State alum, if he were somebody who had ties to the state of Oregon, I would say differently. But, you know, he's got ties to Texas. Littlefield, Texas, where he's born. Texas Tech, where he played college ball. I kind of think his dream job would be to go to Texas Tech. Would Oklahoma State be good for him? Keep an eye on that one, maybe more so than anything else. I think he's a good coach. I think small sample size as a head coach, but I think that he would be the kind of guy that, you know, sure, if he's interested in Oregon State, you talk to him, but I think he could do better. D's in Portland. D, go ahead.
Hey, John. Love the show, as always. I was always curious about your, like, college to, like, pros, and why didn't you go to the pros, or what happened to all that? Thank you, as always, man.
Yeah. Appreciate you, D, in Portland. I'd love to have played minor league baseball or professional baseball. I looked around as a kid, having a dad who played in AAA with the Mets organization, and then, you know, he was in with the Mets when they won the World Series in 1969. He's in AAA. I saw what a professional athlete, the level of talent that a professional athlete has to have as a kid. I was around it. I watched my dad field ground balls. I watched him run wind sprints. I was too young probably when he was playing to see it. I was a really good high school player. I think I hit like 380 as a high school senior. I probably could have gone and, you know, walked on to a Division I program. I had an offer to go to Santa Clara, St. Mary's. But they were telling me, the coaches were being honest with me. They were telling me, hey, you probably won't play till you're a junior or a senior. And even then, you might just be a guy who plays defense in the outfield and pinch runs. They were being honest with me. And I wanted to play. And so I went to a community college. I went to a small college, and I was under no illusion at any point that I was a threat to be drafted or that I was going to play professionally. And I was probably different than most of the guys around me. I had a lot of teammates in high school who thought, oh, we're going to get drafted or we're going here. And I was looking around going, I kind of know. I saw my dad like field ground balls as a 35 or 38 year old guy who was retired from playing minor league baseball, a AAA shortstop. The ball barely touched his glove. It was like watching Omar's Vizquel take ground balls. And I thought to myself, gosh, I don't have that. Like, I don't have that smoothness that he has. So I better just be in this for the fun of it and for the activity of playing. And maybe that was a blessing that he gave me in some ways. Trent Walker's coming up. He says he has a question for me. Stick around and find out what it is.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Trent Walker, Oregon State wide receiver, joins us every week on this show, courtesy of Jamba. You been to your local Jamba lately? Want to be healthy? Jamba's a good stop. Trent Walker has a question for me. I'm going to make him hold it till mid-interview. I'm going to ask him questions first, but he's got one question for me. Trent Walker joining us now. Where are you right now? Set the scene for us. What's the scene around you?
I'm sitting at my apartment here in Corvallis. We just wrapped up some practice. I actually just got done watching some film. Now it's time to just relax, watch some Thursday Night Football.
Do you have a roommate?
I do not.
What is that like? Is this the first time you've lived alone this year?
Yeah. So throughout college, I had a roommate. I lived with four other dudes in a five-bedroom. This is my first time living alone. So, I mean, it's nice to get away, but it definitely doesn't have that on-campus feel of being with the guys 24/7.
Yeah, because that's a little bit of an overcorrection there. Because when you're living with four guys, that's a lot of noise. And now you've gone to no noise. Do people come to your place, or do you find yourself often going to other people's apartments to hang out?
It's a little bit of both. I got a lot of dudes on the team who live near me. I like to think that my spot is the spot that people come to. I know it was like that when I was living with the other guys. I kind of have I never lock my door, so dudes will just roam in here whenever they feel like it, really.
Who decorated the apartment?
My mom and girlfriend, they decorated it.
I like it. So it's not like you have like a neon beer sign hanging on the wall, like mom and girlfriend took care of this.
Yeah, no, I don't really have much hanging on the wall. I got, I think, a little bit too many TVs. I think I have one in every room, which is a little bit unnecessary.
Count them up. How many TVs you have in that whole place?
Let me do some math. One, two, three. I got four in a,
you have
in a,
four
in a two-bedroom
TVs.
Apartment.
Okay. Yeah. All right. You're probably you're probably too many screens. When you watch film, are you watching on like an iPad, or how do you watch film?
I got it on my phone and my iPad, and what I like to do after the games is airplay it onto my big 70-inch TV, and I'll watch the film on that.
You're flexing there with the 70-inch TV. There is something to watching a sporting event on a screen that big in a space like that. Trent Walker is with us. All right, growing up, though, how many TVs in the Walker household growing up? Did you guys just have one in the living room, or were they all over the house? You learned this somewhere, or is this new?
We had two. We had a family room and a living room. I think the only reason for that was because my mom wanted to watch some of her shows.
Yeah.
When my dad constantly had sports on for us to watch. So I think that was the reason for that.
You are looking at film of Washington State. What game do you look at when you want to see it, or is it a mix of all games?
It's a mix. I know the first game I watched was them against Ole Miss, because I know that was a close game. And Ole Miss is the SEC team, so that was definitely the most interesting game I wanted to watch, or I was interested in. But yeah, it's a mix. You try to get a feeling for how the guys play, and then some tendencies on what they like to call just on certain down and distance.
I thought it was a little unfair. I mean, you guys win a game, and then you're on a bye, and you didn't get a chance really to come on and talk too much about it. But I have to think, like I told your coach when he was on yesterday, I said, it's been so long since you guys lost, you guys probably forgot how to lose a game.
Yeah, it was good to get a breather. 8 weeks is a long time to play Division I football. I think. I could be wrong, but I think we might have been the team with the longest like streak of straight games. But, I mean, it was nice to take a breath, but I'm definitely ready to get back out there. I know the other guys are too.
Trent Walker with us, Oregon State wide receiver. All right, Washington State, this is a team I think that gets better every week. I saw them early in the season. I thought, oh, they're not very good. I've watched them like you have the last 3 or 4 weeks. They're playing a lot better. Where are they getting better on the defensive side? Because that's where you're focused as a receiver.
Yeah, I think they play hard and physical. I think there are some blue collar guys over there. I know a good amount of them came with their head coach. I think it was South Dakota State. So I mean, those are guys that just love football, and I think they're ready to go. It's like your old Pac-12 team. Just hard-nosed and physical.
How much does this game mean to you? I mean, is this as close as you guys will get this year to playing a conference title game? You get it twice, but what does this one mean to you, or do they all mean something?
Yeah, I think this one has a little bit more meaning to it, being that it is technically our only conference game this year. It's nice getting them twice, like you said. I got a couple buddies on Wazoo, so personally, it's going to be a fun one. I went to high school with number 44 over there, their backer, and then you guys know Jeremiah Noga transferred over there.
Yeah.
He was a good buddy of mine. So it's going to be fun. There's some personal aspect to it. And the conference thing, it just adds a good mix. I think it's going to be fun. I hope the fans show out. It'll be going.
Trent, Rob Akey now has had a few weeks to settle in as the interim coach. How is he doing? How has the locker room adapted to him?
Yeah, I don't think there's been much shift in how the teams felt and moved about their business. Coach Akey's done an amazing job. I mean, you guys have heard him in his interviews. He's super positive. He's upbeat. And I think it's exactly what we needed in a season like this. He's a guy that people really want to play for and succeed.
All right, so Dan Lanning had a question for me. He asked me a question. You have a question for me. I'm dying to know what you want to ask me. Go, you're on the spot.
Okay, this might be tough to answer on the spot, but
okay.
Give me your Mount Rushmore of Beaver football.
Ooh. Oh, man. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go with, you have to put Terry Baker on there because he has a Heisman Trophy. And so he's got the school's only Heisman. So Terry Baker's on there. I think you have to put Dennis Erickson up there because of what he did in getting to the Fiesta Bowl. I think I need a player representative. I'm probably going to go modern player representative. As much as I'm tempted to put Quiz up there, I'm probably going to put Steven Jackson up there. Just for what he was during that era. That's three. I got one more. I'd be tempted to put Mike Riley. Am I missing a player that I think I need to have? Jonathan Smith, Mike Riley. Who can I put Jonathan Smith up there without people throwing things at me? But I probably would put Riley up there. Riley and Erickson, although, you know, the old timers would say put DeAndros up there. I just think Riley and Erickson, because they brought the program back. I think Terry Baker, and I'm going to put Steven Jackson up there. How wrong am I, Trent Walker? Who else am I forgetting?
No, I like the list. I think I would have gone Quiz instead of Steven Jackson just because I watched Quiz.
Yeah.
But I like the list.
I think Quiz. It, you know, Quiz was the original genesis for you being on this show. I don't know if you knew that, but back in the day when he was a freshman, he wanted to come on, and so we did a segment called Quiz Quiz. And I would ask him questions, you know, that had nothing to do with football, and we would laugh. Like, you know, I'd ask him, like, what's the state, and you know, what's the state bird, and he wouldn't know, you know. And we'd talk about his collection of shoes and everything. And he came on the show every year, and he got better as an interview. He was terrible as a freshman. He got better and better. And then we decided to keep this going after he graduated and left. And so here we are all these years later, Trent. Without Quiz, you wouldn't be here.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I like the quiz concept.
All right, I'm going to play a little bit of it for you. I think I have some of it still because I've been on too long, and I don't want to hear from anybody in your family that they've been listening since you were born or whatever. But here's an example of what we would bring on. all right, quiz. Let's see what I got here. Well, here's Quiz. Quiz talking about Corvallis. Outside of football, what did you learn in Corvallis?
What I learned outside of football? Man, too much of nothing, because I was in football probably 95% of the time.
He learned too much of nothing. He was honest. Too much of nothing. I love that. What do you think about that? Because does football eat up a lot of your time, a lot of the bandwidth?
Oh, yeah. After getting to college, I kind of realized that football is your life. It's everything and some. I know we got like 4 weeks total in the summer, and that's our break. And it's not even 4 weeks like in a row. It's two and two. So I mean, football is everything. Every day you're either working out or you're practicing. So. Football is everything. I think his answer was honest. I think it's pretty true. Like, football is everything in Corvallis.
I want to play another part. I don't know if this is going to be any good or not. So I'm just randomly playing a piece of an interview with Quiz. Okay, so we would ask him We would ask him questions, and then whether or not he got the answer right, that's what we'd play. Okay, so let's start with this. Bob DeCarolis, how many Heisman Trophy winners have the Beavers had?
One, Terry Baker.
There you go. He knew Terry Baker was the only Heisman Trophy winner, so we would play that. That's part of the quiz segment that we did. We did every week on the show. That was a lot of fun. We should bring that back when we bring on next week. We'll quiz Trent Walker. How are you up for that?
Yeah, let's do it. I don't know how good I'll do, but I like to think I know a good amount of things around the
study
around
up
Fort Valles and
study up. There you go. All right, Trent Walker, good luck to you at the game on Saturday, and we'll talk to you next week.
Appreciate you having me on.
There he goes. Wide receiver, Oregon State, Trent Walker. Stephen, were you around for the quiz segments? Were you a part of that?
No, I was definitely not around.
Do you
around.
Remember any of it? Do you remember any of that? You
know? I probably heard it on the radio, like when you guys are doing it, but yeah. I mean, it was still, because what was that? That was,
seven, so like 2007, 8, 7, 9, 7, like 7, 8, 9, right in there.
Like, I was still in college, too, so, like, I wasn't, like, super deep into sports radio at the time, so I can't say that I remember too much of that.
All right, so I'm going to play here's another kind of clip from quiz. This is funny.
Let me ask you about Utah now. You know, here's an opportunity to play another game against a ranked opponent. You go on the road for this. People are talking about letdown. Is it possible for you guys to have a letdown?
Well, we're just trying to keep the same focus that we had last week because we got to show people we can win on the road, too. And people think we're going to have a letdown, but we're going to have the same focus and come out with a victory.
Quiz was like, this has to be late in his tenure because as a freshman, there's no way he could have answered that like that. And in some weird way, and he's not the only one that said this. Quiz said this to me. Isaiah Hodgins said this to me. Because he came on for several years as well. They said, you were part of my media training. Because every week they had to come on the show and they had to answer questions. And it wasn't a news conference. It's a one-on-one conversation. I think Trent Walker's even gotten better this year, having that opportunity to kind of let people know who he is and talk. And so I've encouraged Oregon to do this as well. Oregon says they don't, you know, they want to put an athlete in a position where athlete feels like they have to come on every week. But I think those guys would raise their hand and want to come on every week. And so Trent Walker wants to, at least. Jaden Grant did. So did Jaden Daniels. So did Jaden Robinson a year ago. Isaiah Hodgins, Brandon Cooks, Sean Mannion. We had these guys over the years. We've had them all. I want you to leave it here. You got the bald-faced truth.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Trent Walker bringing off the Mount Rushmore answer. How'd I do with that, Stephen? How'd I do that compared to what you would have answered?
I think our lists are pretty similar. I think the three names that you had at the start, Terry Baker, Dennis Erickson, Steven Jackson, I think those should be pretty common. Like, those should be the first three. The fourth was the really one you got up for debate.
How do you leave Riley off, given that he set the stage for Erickson and then sustained after Erickson? I have a hard time leaving him off, but I want to put Jaquizz in there. I think Jonathan Smith deserves consideration. I think you could go back and talk about DeAndros. Where else does your mind go?
Yeah, Jonathan Smith's always my first answer, but then the way he left Oregon State and the way it was just so salty for fans, like, you can't put him on there. Like, had he not done that, I think he's the most obvious answer to be that number four.
What about Chad Johnson?
Yeah, Ocho Cinco's another good one, but he only played the 1 year. Right? Like, he played 1 year at Oregon State. That's my thing against Ocho Cinco, but I think he's in consideration. You talk about Brandon Cooks, Sean Mannion, a lot of those guys back then. So that's why I think there's really not an obvious
Derek Anderson. Answers. Derek Anderson was really good, but
Mike Haas, I mean, he won, yeah, he won
really
with the Blitnikoff.
I think the best football player, Heisman Trophy aside, the best football player I ever saw play at Oregon State was Steven Jackson. I think he was just the best.
Like Simonton, like, because think about that run they had there on Sports Illustrated. Like
Steven Jackson was a better player than Simonton.
100%, yes.
Yeah, I think Terry Baker has the Heisman. He has to be on there. I would love for that question. We should do it from a Ducks standpoint as well. Who's on the Ducks Mount Rushmore? 503-417-7575. Who's on the Oregon State Mount Rushmore? Dave's in Vancouver. Dave, what's up, man?
Well, the Oregon State thing, I called in and I mentioned Ocho Cinco, and Steven shot me down on that one. Hmm. But I didn't realize he only played there for a year.
I still think he gets consideration year aside. I mean, I think what they did in beating, you know, Notre Dame in that Fiesta Bowl, I want to give Erickson all the credit, but the fact of the matter is he had some guys. He had guys on that team, and Chad Johnson was one of them.
I also have a random question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so I know you collect sports cards and always have, and me as well. Have you ever ripped a pack of Pokemon cards?
My kids have. I think there's an interesting thing that goes on with our brain chemistry when we open up any pack of trading cards, whether it's sports related or anything. There's something happening in my brain that's not unlike what happens when people watch those YouTube videos of somebody open a blind box or blind bag. There's like some payoff happening there. I don't even understand Pokemon. I don't even know what I'm looking for, Dave. And yes, I will, with the kids, open up a pack of Pokemon cards, and I'm excited to do it for some reason, and I don't know why.
I'm a novice, but I'm addicted. And I don't know, it's kind of fun.
I love
it. But it's also a money pit, too.
Yeah. All these things are. Look, and here's the other thing. I'm sitting on a binder of Garbage Pail Kids from the 1980s. I think they're worth something. I'm sure. I had Star Wars cards back in the day. And I look at today and I see these Star Wars cards. And I'm like, I think I had that card. And people are like, yeah, it's worth like $500. Baseball trading cards are interesting because the problem I had with my baseball card collection was, like a lot of people my age, we sort of got into the trading cards. And then there was a period of like a decade where they were mass producing the cards. Fleer, Score, Upper Deck came on the scene, 1989, and Leaf was around, Topps and Donruss and others were around, and they were mass producing the cards, and nothing from that era is worth anything. It's a bunch of junk. And so what happened was, like, during the early part of the pandemic, I remember going into the garage, like a lot of people did, and I was like, this is something we can do during the pandemic. Let's open up all these boxes and let's see what I got. And what I came to realize was a lot of the stuff that I had was worth nothing. It was worthless. It was junk. And, you know, now they have figured out, Steven, you have kids that collect now. They figured out that the excitement and the value in trading cards is not just in speculative purchasing of rookie cards like it used to be. It's not just in like the vintage card eras of truly having something that was unique. It's in like the same logic that they used in Willy Wonka. It's the golden ticket you're looking for. You're looking for that refractor that is one of one, and that signed autographed jersey patch card that's one of one. And it's literally like finding the golden ticket in the Wonka bar.
Speaking of Star Wars cards, do you have the 1977 Topps Luke Skywalker? Because that just had a record sale just a couple days ago.
Let me look it up. I'll tell you.
It graded a PSA 10. It just sold for $268,000.
I don't think I need to look this up. I don't think I want to look it up. I think it's going to be a painful thing.
My mom actually might have this card.
Yeah, I had a 77. Yeah, I had that card. It's got the blue border around it.
Yep.
Yeah.
PSA 10 just sold for $268,000.
Mine was not likely a PSA 10. Now, for people who don't know, that's professional sports authenticators, PSA, and other grading companies will grade the cards. They'll look at the borders. They'll look at the edges. They'll look at, is it centered? Is it a perfect card? A 10 out of 10 is a perfect card. My cards, Steven, were treated like trading cards were supposed to be treated. I would stack them up. I would sort them out on the living room floor. I would look at them. I had all those. That 77 Topps Star Wars set was 100% in my sweet spot. I don't know what happened to the cards. I'm sure they were tossed and thrown out. And the other thing I had was, because Star Wars was my thing. I was like 7, 8 years old, right? Like, that was right in that sweet spot when I started collecting. That number one PSA 10, $268,000. May the force be with you. My goodness. What else? Like, your kids are collecting, though. Back to the Wonka thing. It's like finding the golden ticket. Like, you don't just want to open up a pack of basketball cards or football cards and get the Jaden Daniels rookie or the Justin Herbert rookie or the Victor Wembanyama or the Cooper flag. You're looking for that certain rare refractor card that is like a one of one, or maybe it's signed or it's autographed.
Yeah, that's those are the big chases now, is the serial numbered cards and the autographs as well. Like, that, you're not just looking for the hot rookie. It can be anybody, like you said. If it's just a Hall of Famer, a legend, you know, Patrick Mahomes, like, it's big news when he starts putting his autographs back out there in certain products. Like, it's a big thing. So yeah, it's not just necessarily like the hot rookie that we all grew up with, like with the Ken Griffey Jr. rookie. Like, that's what everybody wanted. No, like, it's pretty much everybody now, and everyone's coming back with these autographs.
I think too, there's for me, what I should have been buying in like the late 80s, I should have been buying vintage cards, because what I ended up doing during the pandemic was consolidating all of my cards that I thought were worth a lot of money and selling them, and then turning around and I went and bought like vintage cards. I got into tobacco cards, the T206s. I got into trying to collect the cards of the early 1950s. And I ultimately decided that anything before 1959 was truly rare. Like, right by today's standards, it's all the scarcity is what matters. It's the old vintage cards that are really rare. There's just so few of them that are out there.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
In the wake of the NBA betting scandal, the league and its partner sportsbooks are reviewing what types of bets are most vulnerable to manipulation and considering whether bettors should be allowed to wager on such bets and how much. Before the season, the NBA identified that missed free throws, fouls, and turnovers were susceptible to manipulation. Because that makes sense, Steven. Like, you know, a guy can miss a free throw on purpose. Or commit a foul and go, hey, I need to get three fouls. Okay, let's do that. Or, oops, I turned the ball over. So FanDuel and DraftKings agreed to the NBA's request. And on in-game bets on missed free throws and fouls and turnovers, ongoing discussions about prop bets, over-under bets on points or rebounds. Here's my question is, I get it. It's like an upsell inside the sports wagering business to get you in there to go bet, like, what's the spread on the game? And then you get in there and they get you on, oh, here's the special of today. It's a single game parlay. Or this over-under bet on how many points James Harden will score, free throws that Luka Doncic will have. That they get you as an upsell on that. Not necessarily the reason you're coming in there. But I just kind of wonder, Steven, like, how many bets do you need? Like, sometimes if I look at the DraftKings app, it goes, like, there's just too much on the menu. And maybe I'm weird, but there's just too much on the menu. Meanwhile, Chauncey Billups has hired renowned trial lawyer Mark McCasey to defend him into the federal investigation into illegal gambling. McCasey has some deep ties to the president, President Trump. Sam Amick of The Athletic reporting this. So Chauncey's lawyered up. And meanwhile, DraftKings and FanDuel are huddling with the NBA to figure out, hey, how do we get this how do we get this done? How many things do we need inside the sports book? How many offerings do we need? How many different kinds of bets do you need? I mean, it feels to me like it's overkill when I get in there, but maybe I'm not reflective of the typical gambler. Because, for example, the Dodgers and Blue Jays have a Game 6 coming up tomorrow. The line on this game is the Dodgers are a 1.5 run favorite. The money line has the Dodgers at -145 to win the game. Okay, simple enough. The over-under on total runs scored, 7.5. You want to go beyond that? Well, there's a bet you can make on the Dodgers or the Blue Jays to win the series. Blue Jays are obviously favored because they only need one win. They're at -240. The Dodgers, not a bad bet if you think the Dodgers are going to win it at 2-1 to win this thing. If I would have told you you could have the Dodgers at 2-1 to win the World Series with Game 6, you would have jumped all over it. Now you can go further. Batter propositions. Shohei Ohtani to hit a home run, +213. Vladimir Guerrero to hit a home run, +442. It goes on and on and on. How about RBI? How about total bases? How about hits plus runs plus RBI? How about pitcher props? How about strikeouts in the game? How about first inning? Who's going to win the first inning? Will there be a run scored in the first inning? How about this one? How about will Shohei Ohtani and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. combine to hit 6 or more home runs in the series? You can get that at -295. How about this one? Who's going to hit the most home runs in the World Series? How about this one? Who is it a 6-game series or a 7-game series? Who's the MVP? There's so many offerings. That's within baseball. The NBA, the NFL, the NHL, UFC. What else? EuroLeague, table tennis, soccer, the tennis tour, horse racing,
snooker,
NASCAR. I mean, how much do we need in here, Stephen? Like, if you have a problem with gambling, this is the place to be. And they're not there to stop you from gambling. They're there to keep you gambling and keep you inside that sports book. How much do we need? Like, I just kind of wonder if the NBA should be like, look, over-unders on teams, fine. Lines, fine. Anything that's a prop bet involving an individual player, no.
Are you suggesting that, like, these sports leagues basically create their own sports book?
They're kind of making the rules for FanDuel and DraftKings, aren't they?
I don't know, because I'm guessing DraftKings hires people to make all these lines. Like, the NBA is not saying you have to put, the points, rebounds, assists prop up there. They're not saying who's going to be the first to 10 points in the first quarter. What you're suggesting is the NBA should say, look, we're not going to deal with DraftKings anymore. We're going to regulate all this, and you can only bet on the point spread. You can only bet on, you know, player props if it's points, rebounds, and assists, not combined, not anything. Like, we're going to be the ones that are in control of everything, and we're not going to put it up to anybody else. That way, we have it regulated.
But I'm also not relying upon the gambling revenue. I'm not coming from a position saying, hey, I want as much revenue as possible. The sportsbooks are.
Right.
So the sportsbooks are going, hey, we want these player prop bets are really popular, particularly in the NBA. Growing percentage of the amount wagered on basketball player prop bets, especially popular in parlays, which increase the payout amounts on the winning bets. So the partner sports books are listening, but also going, hey, man, you're cutting into our business here. But if I'm the NBA, I have to worry about consumer confidence in my sport, the public thinking that the games are fixed, the public having to worry. I've heard from so many people since the Chauncey Billups arrest, who have said, oh, this game, or oh, that game, or did you see when he did this? And some of it, I think, just has to do with the fact that Chauncey wasn't a very good coach. And people are now going back and unpacking all of his weird moves. And he took he took Denny Advia out of this game where he was killing it, and they were on a 10-0 run, and he took him out of the game. That has to be a fix. And the part of the problem is, he's such a bad coach. He was a bad coach. He's a bad coach that you could question a lot of things that Chauncey Billups did and said, oh, look at this. This looks fishy. And his defense, I think he's going to be able to lawyer up here. He has. And I think in his defense, he's going to be like, hey, I did a lot of squirrely things.
I just suck.
You know? I suck. Maybe I'm not a very good coach.
I'm with you. You hear a lot now. You see a lot of people blaming, you know, the players in the NBA. Like, look, they must be, you know, rigging this game. Someone has to have money on it. I get it. There's lots of examples that are some weird things that happen, but it's not just the NBA. It happens in all sports. So are we going to say that every single sport, every single game is now fixed? I don't know that I'm willing to go that far. And I think it's just kind of the easy joke to say, oh, look, the Trailblazers game. Yep, they were up by 20 in the fourth quarter last night against the Jazz, but the Jazz ended up covering the game, which was 2.5 or 3.5, depending on what you got. So maybe it's Tiago Splitter. Is he rigging games now because the Blazers gave up a 20-point lead in the fourth quarter? No, I don't think that they are. I think it's just the easy punchline that you can have now, especially in the NBA because of the Tim Donaghy scandal in the past and now with Chauncey Billups.
I think, you know, ESPN had this Ramona Shelburne story. I don't know if you saw it, but kind of talking about what the Blazers players knew and what they, you know, and a lot of them are saying, like, you know, we didn't even know he gambled. You know, we didn't know that that's who he was. I don't know if Chauncey gambles either. I think it would help Chauncey if people looked and said he was in there because he liked to gamble, because the alternative is he was in there because he was conspiring with the mob, and, you know, and it wasn't at all about gambling. So I'm kind of hoping, like, in the end, like, if you want him to survive this thing, and I think people would hold out hope that, you know, we all want to believe people are good. We want to believe that, no, I don't want to believe that he was paid $50,000 to participate in a rigged poker game. But, you know, the FBI says they have a $50,000 payment, that they have bank records showing he received this payment after he participated in a poker game. And, you know, his attorney's come out and they've issued a statement. He's on indefinite leave. He's obviously leaving the courtroom in that Clutch Sports hoodie. You know, I didn't even know he was a gambler was the lead quote in that ESPN story. I would hope, like, it comes out, oh yeah, he was totally a gambler. He was just in the wrong place, wrong time. But it doesn't appear to line up that way for Chauncey. But I don't know. What do you do if you're the NBA? Do you, like, you have to do something, because this is about confidence in your product and the impropriety. It's even worse if there's just the cloud of suspicion. It's almost like we need to know what happened. We need to know where it went wrong. Cause if you could figure out from a league perspective, this is what happened. This is where, you know, this is where the Terry Rozier and Chauncey Billups and Damon Jones, this is how they became associated with this, with the organized crime families of New York. This is what they did. This is the point of contact. Once you figure that out, then I think you can say, okay, where's the problem? Because it may prove that the problem is just, this is human nature, and it's too big, and it's too easy now with social media and DMs to get to star athletes in these positions. Or it may prove that all these guys like to gamble, and they really like to gamble, and they ended up in the wrong room at some time, and they ended up in debt in a position where they were leveraged by the crime families of New York, and they had to participate in these schemes, or they had to share information. If you can determine that it's that, then as a league, you can come forth and you can say, all right, here's our rule. NBA players are not allowed to gamble on anything. If you are caught gambling on anything, any sport, even non-basketball, even on the golf course, even playing in a poker game, you're done. Because if that's how this happened, then you have to think about that as a possibility. You have to take that on, and you'll get opposition from the Players Association, but you have to take that on as a league, because you have to restore what was credibility in the league. I mean, it's been flimsy at different times. Think about it. The league's drug testing policy is a lie. Attendance is a lie. Oh, it's a sellout, but then you see it on TV and you're like, there are a lot of empty seats there. The fouls and the star treatment of foul, like, players who are, you know, it's a foul for one guy, but not a foul for another guy. The officiating questions about Tim Donaghy and others. The Sacramento Kings getting, you know, probably hosed out of, an NBA championship. You know, it's, you kind of look back at the history of David Stern and Adam Silver's league, and you go, there's a lot here. And that's why the Kawhi Leonard thing, too, is part of this conversation. Because if you don't have rules that the owners are willing to follow as it pertains to paying players, you know, who's compensating who or who's circumventing the salary cap. If you like, if you have like the white collar crime of the NBA happening, like you can't really look at the players and be like, hey, the problem is just that a few guys were gambling. I think the problem is there's a lot of guys gambling. I think there are a lot of players within these teams that are on team flights. I'll bet you, poor choice of words, that there isn't a team flight in the NBA that doesn't include a wager of some kind. I think the stories that I have heard about the Blazers back in the day is just gambling on the team plane. Dale Davis talked about it. There's a Blazer player who owed another player $10,000 on a flight because of the way they were gambling. There's some guys who don't gamble, but a lot of those guys on the planes, that's how they pass the time, you know, as they're traveling around for 41 road games.
It's also the competitive nature that they have in them.
Like, yes.
It kind of fulfills that hole that they have when they're not playing in a game. Like, oh, this is competition. And it's something that, you know, if you lose, like, you're going to feel something about it. And if you win, you're going to feel something good, too, because money won is better than money earned.
I'm here to say this, too. I saw Dale Davis. He's a guy that I'm curious. I would love to get him on the show and talk with him about this, because in his time in Portland, you know, he's a veteran guy. I think he was incredibly honest. I think, you know, he talked openly about the gambling that was going on in the back of the you know, team plane and all that stuff. But Dale Davis, I saw him on a number of occasions challenge media members to wagers.
Get him on the show.
Two bets that Dale Davis, I witnessed Dale Davis making with media members. He used to shoot around and shoot trick shots at the end of practices. The doors would open, the media members would come in, and largely the sucker media members viewed a guy like Dale Davis as what? Kind of looks like a stiff on the court. Right, Steven? Like, how would you describe like how Dale Davis's game looked on the court?
Big bruiser.
Okay.
Inside, interior, yeah. Bruising around people.
Okay, so he, like, what we don't really grasp as civilians is how gifted even a guy who has a reputation as a big bruiser is with his touch and his shot relative to civilians, not relative to, like, other NBA players. But Dale Davis was really good with trick shots. He would get, like, behind the backboard and stand on the baseline behind the basket. The angles are all screwy. They're wonky. They look wonky to the rest of us, but a 7-footer or a 6-foot-11 Dale Davis could shoot the ball over the basket, straight up in the air, high trajectory, over the basket, and drop it back down on the other side through the basket. And he could do it as easily maybe as shooting a free throw. Like, it wasn't a hard shot for him. I saw him try it every day, and who knows how many times he was trying that shot when nobody was watching. But I watched him at the end of the shoot around. He would grab a ball and he'd come down to the baseline and he would shoot it over the basket. I saw him probably make that shot like 70% of the time. He could make it. It was, you know, it's like a 2-foot shot, but you're behind the basket. You know what I'm saying, Steven? You're behind the basket, you're shooting up over from the baseline and trying to drop the ball down at a tough angle. You're going to bring rain with the shot, a tough angle. But he could drop it down, and damn, how frequently he made it surprised me. You understand the shot?
I do, yes. And you are right. These NBA guys are incredibly talented. And if you get there, if you ever go to an NBA game and you get there a little bit early, like, you can kind of tell. I remember this was back in the day when I was in college. I watched the Birdman. Remember Birdman with the fun hair and the tattoos?
Yep.
I watched
Chris Anderson.
I watched him hit 15 straight threes, dead swishes from everywhere. He then was moving backwards, hitting them from the crowd, from the bench. It did not matter. Yet he wasn't allowed to shoot threes in the games because he wasn't good enough at them.
Yeah. And so Dale Davis would shoot that shot and he would turn to whoever is standing nearby as a media member. And there was this media member who worked for the Vancouver newspaper. He called him Big Red because he was about 6'5". His name was Andrew. And he turned to Andrew one day and he said, $20. I can make this shot. $20. And Andrew goes, you're on. And Dale Davis swished it, you know, from behind the backboard. He challenged another media member because we look at Dale Davis. You said he's a stiff, right? He challenged another media member to a foot race at the end of a shoot around or practice, because he said, I bet you that I can beat you in a foot race. And Dale Davis, you know, he's 6'11". He's not a fast player by NBA standards. But when you compare him to one of these schmucks who's holding a notepad. Like, he's, you know, he's Usain Bolt.
Well, I remember back when Odin got drafted one, he was the number one time in the from baseline to baseline in the NBA draft combine. Yeah. He was number one. And that guy's 7'1" and is the biggest guy.
Dale Davis challenged a media member to run baseline to baseline. He was at midcourt in three strides. You know, like, it was over. And so, you know, he won those wagers. He told me about that plane ride. He said somebody lost $10,000 on it. You know, I think it's a fascinating conversation. I'd love for listeners to chime in on this. 503-417-7575. What should the league do as it pertains to its conversations with DraftKings and FanDuel? What should be a legal wager that's on the board? What should be banned? Mike, welcome to the program. What's up, man?
Say, John, man, I'm going to give you some food for thought about Chauncey Phillips. You remember the FBI had been investigating this for 3 years or more. And I look back at when Chauncey Phillips was interviewing for the job for the Trailblazers, and you said that they hired him, you know, you thought it was suspicious that they went ahead and hired him.
Shouldn't have hired him. I don't like that they hired him.
Now, I think that the FBI got with the Blazers and set that up for them to hire him to keep him out front because they knew at the time they were investigating him. That's the way I see that. Mm-hmm. And also, since the mob is involved, I think one or two things is going to happen. First of all, if he's going to snitch on the mob, he's going to have to go into witness protection. Or if he don't, then he's going to probably do some time. So that's how I see it, man.
Yeah.
Talk to you later.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that when you involve the mob. I don't know that I would go as far as to believe the conspiracy that the FBI had the Blazers hire Chauncey Billups. Because if you really think about it, it's simple to understand why Neil
back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I don't buy the conspiracy that the Trailblazers were told by the FBI to hire Chauncey Billups so they could keep that investigation going. I don't buy it for a second, because if you really think about the logic of the Blazers, you know, pivoting to Chauncey Billups, it has to do with Neil Olshey and his own desire for self-preservation. The Blazers at that time were in this position, as you may recall, where they knew they were facing a rebuild. They knew they were likely facing a rebuild without Damian Lillard. And Neil Olshey needed somebody to come in and coach that team that was a little bit experimental, because when it went wrong and when they ended up not being competitive, he needed somebody to be like, well, that's the problem. We got the wrong coach. He needed a scapegoat. And so he brought in a coach who had no proof of performance, somebody who would do what Neil Olshey wanted him to do. And I think Olshey hired Chauncey Billups as a strategy, because it possibly led to Neil Olshey surviving beyond one more coach. Remember, he threw Terry Stotts under the bus. It was Stotts' problem. It was a coaching issue. It wasn't the roster that was broken. It was the coach. If you really think about it, the product that you currently see on the court for the Trailblazers that has been largely, would you say, enthusiastic, Stephen? People enthusiastic about where the Blazers are right now?
Yeah, I think most fans that have been watching the Blazers are very enthusiastic and excited, I would almost also say. Excited and enthusiastic about where the team's going.
Yeah, so this roster, it's not a Neil Olshey production. This is not his jam. This is Joe Cronin's roster. I have to acknowledge that maybe none of this happens if they don't hire Chauncey Billups. Maybe they're in a totally different situation with Neil Olshey building the roster, because I don't know if he would have been willing to go all the way into a rebuild and kind of make some of the moves that the Blazers have made. I think he would have been more focused on trying to win a few games now than Joe Cronin was at different times. And Cronin certainly made some questionable moves, but I think if you are a Blazer fan, I think you kind of got to look at what has happened, and you got to ask yourself if you know, if the I think the FBI was opportunistic. I think they waited until the NBA season started. They could have announced this indictment a week before. They could have done it in the preseason. Adam Silver would have preferred that. Doesn't interrupt their season. Doesn't become a big story when everybody's supposed to be talking about the games. The start of the games would have been very different. And Cash Patel coming out and saying, this is, you know, this is the, you know, insider trading scandal in the NBA. You know, it's fuel on the fire. So I think the timing of it is interesting. I don't think, though, that I can go to the level that the caller wants to go, where you go, oh, this was, you know, a major conspiracy where, you know, the NBA was in on it and the FBI was in on it and the Blazers were in on it. I don't think so. The Blazers didn't want this problem. They don't want the issue in the question of a coach being part of a scandal like that. No, it's, I think this 100% has to do with just, you know, Chauncey Billups and some others doing some things they shouldn't have been doing. Steven, you agree with that? You know, or do you go with the callers? You know, is there a chance there that this has to do with more than just basketball?
I don't see that. I do love a good conspiracy theory. I love all different types of theories to keep your mind open, but I do not see that would be one of them.
Feels a little far-fetched.
Yeah.
A little bit far-fetched.
It's very, like, Reddit for-me.
All right. We're gonna pivot into a little bit of Punch It audio. We got the best sound from all around. Let's do it.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Kirby Smart, Georgia coach, said, hey, who's the best conference in America? Well, ask the NFL who has the best conference. More SEC players in the NFL than any other conference.
This is funny to me to hear all the national pundits and the different people from the conferences, and there's all this media bias and the game day bias. And hey, man, just go ask the NFL. Just go ask the NFL, because their job is to observe talent. Now you can say, well, they can't equate for how good a team is. Just go ask general managers and go ask scouts where they're looking for D linemen, O linemen, where they pick their players from. And you know, it's not that they don't pick them from other conferences. They do. But the line of scrimmage and the game that's played in this league, I just feel like it's different.
Different in the SEC. I think probably that holds up for most years and in the past. But I wonder if it'll hold up for the future of college football in the NFL. Because I kind of think I see the Big Ten threatening the SEC's place. And I think Nick Saban coming out, you know, he had some pretty strong comments about whether or not the LSU job was a good job or not. And he said, yeah, it used to be about facilities. It used to be about the commitment of your university. It used to be about a lot of things that it's not about anymore. And one of those things is that now it's about money. How much money do you have? He who has the money makes the rules. He who has the money gets to the playoff. Speaking of the playoff, Reese Davis, ESPN, says he's intrigued on what the College Football Playoff Selection Committee will do with Oregon and with Georgia Tech. Here's Reese Davis.
The two teams that I am most interested in seeing how the selection committee evaluates them, Oregon and Georgia Tech. Because Georgia Tech, while winning, has, you know, they've pulled some out of the fire.
Oh yeah.
They got a lot of help. Their strength of schedule is average at best. Oregon looks really good. But they, you know, their one big game, biggest game anyway, they have, you know, have some solid wins, but their one big game, they lost, you know, and their big game feel at Penn State, you know, didn't materialize. So it's sort of like that's still a good win. I don't want to say that's not a good win. It
yeah.
is.
Sure.
So I think like Oregon really passes the eye test.
Sure.
So I would still, you know, I'd still have been highly ranked.
There is no eye test. Can we stop with that? There's no eye test. There's you winning games. You go 10-2 and you're in a power conference, you're likely getting into the playoff. There may be some question about, you know, how many 10-2 teams are there. There'll be some question about your strength of schedule. I'm not worried or concerned or curious about where Oregon's going to be. I'm more looking at the history of this poll. The committee, historically, in the first week, has followed the AP Top 25. So if you look at the AP Top 25 sort of entering this weekend and then kind of look at what happens this weekend, you're going to have a pretty good guess as to what the committee's going to do. They generally will follow what the AP Top 25 is. And I think it's human nature. I think there are some people at the CFP selection committee who are very interested in, like, no, let's not have the controversy. Let's see a bigger sample size. I think there's some hesitation to look at that and go, let's do something wildly different. The questions I have are like at 10, 11, 12, 14. Is San Diego State going to appear on this poll? What do they have to do to get in there?
So you don't think you don't think the Penn State debacle of a season is going to hurt Oregon? Because looking at Penn State's schedule, they're at Ohio State and then Indiana. That's two losses. They're going to be 3-6. Best case scenario, they go 6-6 with the Michigan State and Nebraska Rutgers. Like, they could win those. They could lose. Who knows? So if you take out that Penn State win, what's Oregon's best win going to be? At Washington, if they beat them? At Iowa? Like, those aren't, like, the headliner wins that you would want if you're going to be a top four team.
But you're thinking, I think you're thinking more like, is Oregon a top four team after the way they lost to Indiana? Because I don't think the Penn State thing hurts them. I think that what hurts them is the way they lost to Indiana. And so, are they a top four team after that Indiana game? That's the question to me is, like, I don't think the Penn State win drags Oregon down.
I don't think they're going to have a chance to be a top four team anymore. That's my point. I think if you're Oregon, and maybe fans are going to be happy because they won't have that bye week.
But Oregon's not a top four team right now. They're not a top four team.
Right, and if they win out, they're still not going to be a top four team.
I absolutely think they'd be a top four team if they win out. They're 11-1. And they're sitting there at 11-1 with wins over Washington and USC. And, you know, remember.
They'll have wins over no top 25 teams.
But you have to. You don't know that because you don't know if Washington's going to win every game except for Oregon or USC. USC wins this week at Nebraska, and USC's only loss the rest of the season is, you know, losing to Oregon. Those are good wins. Oregon can't control that. And I know what you're saying, but look, Ohio State, Indiana, you know, likely at the top of this poll. Texas A&M, Alabama, Georgia. Then Oregon's going to be like 6 or 7. But here's the other thing. Alabama and Georgia are going to play. Ohio State, Indiana, that'll get settled too. We don't know what's going to happen, you know, as these teams get down the stretch. And by the way, Penn State plays Ohio State and Indiana back-to-back. Like, Penn State wins one of those games, does it make that Oregon game better? Let's not wring our hands and fret until we need to wring our hands and fret. Like, this is like they're issuing a storm warning and the TV stations are telling us Snowmageddon's coming. But I'm looking outside and I'm going, yeah, it's overcast.
I'm pulling a Duckmageddon right now. Come on.
I know. But I think look at the AP Top 25, okay? So in your latest poll, you got Ohio State, Indiana, Texas A&M, Alabama, Georgia, Oregon's idol. By the way, Alabama's idol. By the way, Texas A&M's idol. So Ohio State's playing Penn State this week. Let's see how that game goes. Indiana's playing at Maryland. Let's see how that game goes. I don't expect either of those teams to lose. But I don't necessarily think that the committee's going to look at Oregon and go, they're 7-1, and gosh, you know, their best win is what, Penn State? And Penn State's not very good. I don't think the committee is necessarily going to downgrade Oregon for who they played. They're going to look at Oregon and say, all right, they weren't close to Indiana. And if Indiana's our number two team, Oregon's 6 or 7 or 8, the way they played them. I think that's the more likely thing. The thing that I'm interested in, though, if you look historically at that first week of the ranking, Stephen, it usually mirrors the AP Top 25. And so don't anybody tell me that AP poll that everybody goes, oh, it's just for fun. Preseason poll just for fun. I won't buy that from anybody because when these rankings come out on Tuesday, you know, granted, Vanderbilt's playing at Texas this weekend. Georgia Tech's got North Carolina State this weekend. Miami's at SMU. Like, at the end of this, what happens this weekend is going to matter, but I think the AP Top 25 and Tuesday night's college football playoff rankings are going to be very similar to each other. We'll see. Dan Lanning says he's not going anywhere.
And so your interest level in leaving Oregon is less than because
zero.
Of this?
Zero. Yeah.
Zero. Zero.
Yeah, I'm not leaving Oregon. Yeah, as long as I win. That's what I always tell our my kids. Yeah. Right? If your dad wins, we'll be at Oregon. So I got to win. Right? That's how it changes.
I mean, that meshes with what Lanning has told me privately. He and his wife would like their kids to graduate from the same school, same high school. But some of that is incumbent upon him winning games and not getting fired. Blue Jays beat the Dodgers. They have a 3-2 lead in the best of seven World Series. This is how it started yesterday. Davis Schneider leading off the game. That sound is his father, who was filming and watching from Dodger Stadium. A lot of quiet Dodger fans around him, some Blue Jay fans, but Davis Schneider with a leadoff home run. So cool to hear a dad that excited. You got to be kidding me. Really neat to see Toronto messing up the Dodgers Cinderella story, even though I'm kind of rooting for the Dodgers. Daniel Jeremiah, NFL draft. Talking about the college quarterbacks, he doesn't see a lot that he likes there.
I mean, the guys that are kind of sitting there with teams right now that they're trying to, you know, work through, the two names you hear more than any other, Mendoza at Indiana, you know, he's a good player, and then Ty Simpson at Alabama. Now, neither one of these guys, you know, approach the grade level of the, you know, that class we were just talking about with Drake May, Jaden Daniels, Caleb Williams. Like, no, I would say even below Cam Ward from last year in terms of the grade that they'll be carrying. And there's a bunch of other guys that, you know, coming into the year I thought would be no-brainers to come out. Lenora Sellers was my favorite one. He just hasn't quite had the year that he'd like to have, and that hasn't been a great supporting cast around him either. So, he's kind of one of those candidates. Okay, he can go back to school and help himself. You know, the Arch thing is kind of played out. We've got a really good sense he's not going to be coming out. So, it's an interesting group. There's a lot of things to like about these guys. I don't think there's, you know, I don't, at this point in time, there's not that buzz of being like, man, thank goodness we got the first or second overall pick.
Look, no buzz around the QBs. That's sure to change, though. We saw guys like Tyler Shuck end up going higher in the draft. I think that's something to say now. Nobody's jumping out. Keep an eye on this as it unfolds, because teams will need quarterbacks, and there are quarterbacks in college football. But it does make me wonder if Shedeur Sanders would have been far better off staying in college. What do you think about that, Steven? Did Shedeur make a mistake coming out the way he did?
No, because unless Travis Hunter was staying too. Like, I think if you even throw Shedeur on this Colorado team, it's not like they're going to be very good. So, no, I don't think he necessarily made a mistake unless he had the agreement like, hey, Travis, you staying too? Yeah, okay, well, let's go put some more numbers. But no, Colorado wasn't going to be very good with
him. I don't know, though. He would have been a much higher pick being that guy in this
you
draft.
You think so? Because I think also going into the NFL draft process, it would have been the same exact thing. I don't think it would have changed Shedeur's outlook on the way he was going about this business.
Well, I don't like where he ended up for him. You know, I think I'm not saying that it was wrong, but I think he could have done a lot better. Joel Klatz thinks Ohio State Penn State is a fascinating game. I agree.
I'm fascinated by this because of the level of knowledge that each group is going to have against the other. Ryan Day and Brian Hartline are going to know exactly how they want to attack Jim Knowles and his tendencies, the way he adjusts his defense. They've been with him for multiple years. They've seen it. Meanwhile, Knowles is going to have the exact same institutional knowledge of Ohio State's offense, Ryan Day, and Brian Hartline. What they like to do, what their tendencies are, what their formation tells are, he will know that specifically. So someone's going to have to break tendencies here to gain the advantage.
I'll go further. I'm interested in that game because I want to have a baseline for Oregon compared with Ohio State. And it might be different because James Franklin's not part of this game. But I want to see Ohio State, Penn State, because if Ohio State beats them 56-0, it tells me a little something. Meanwhile, Phil Parker is the D coordinator at Iowa. They'll get Oregon after the bye week. Listen to how he refers to Oregon here.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they can execute. They have some, you know, you start looking at their personnel. They got probably about three or four backs that are really good backs and highly touted backs. The receivers are, you know, a couple of young freshmen in there playing that, and they can run. They're fast. So you worry about that. And the two tight ends are dynamic and the big offensive line. So they have the whole package. It's well-funded, if I put it that way. But they're very, very talented.
I wasn't sure about Oregon at Iowa. That's not the right move by Phil Parker. Steven, what is he doing? He just gave Dan Lanning everything he needs for his well-funded.
Because he was doing a great job, right? He did a great job of saying, look, they're great at all these positions. And then later on, he went to talk about Dante Moore, how great he is. You just had to end it there. Just say, look, this team's great. This team's deep. You know, they've beaten some good teams. And, you know, they can run, pass, do it all. They can block. But no, then he had to add the well-funded part. What is he thinking?
What did he get out of that?
How do these coaches not learn from Mike Gundy?
Yeah, it doesn't help you. And in the end, I'm left going, oh, man, like if you're Kirk Ferentz and you just heard your D coordinator give Dan Lanning everything he needs to get that vein going in the side of his neck. And feel like he, you know, oh, we're disrespected. Like, that was exactly what Dan Lanning needed. I wondered about that Iowa-Oregon game. Now I'm going, okay, Oregon will be fine. Like, I just don't know why it is. All right, when you leave it here, you got the bald-faced truth. We'll have the 5 and 5 coming up top of the hour.
Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Well, it'll be the first of a two-game series between Oregon State and Washington State Saturday at Reser Stadium. Beavers on a win streak. Washington State playing well, even in defeat in recent weeks.
Is it
Pac-12 championship game?
Is it a big deal, the Pac-12 championship with these two teams now that they're going to be joining the conference next season?
I think it's underwhelming right now. I think if Oregon State had been better, and if it was a 7-1 Oregon State, playing against a 4-4, if Oregon State was planned for Tuesday night positioning for the College Football Playoff Selection Committee, and its only loss was to Oregon, I think we would have a much bigger feel to this. I think from a Pac-12 perspective, most people are looking at Oregon State and Washington State and going, hey, they're just trying to get in position for 2026. And so Big CBS has the game. It's at 4:30. Probably means more to Washington State than Oregon State. Washington State's a 3.5-point favorite at Reser Stadium. I have no trust in the Beavers, nor should anybody who has seen them play this year. Yes, they have a win over Lafayette, but come on. You know, it's still sketchy. I am left looking at this and going, underwhelming. Pac-12 is going to try to sell it as it's a big deal. I saw a couple tweets. This is it. This game matters, all that stuff. I don't think it matters that much. I think if it were 5-3 Oregon State against 4-4 Washington State, it would mean something. But 1-7 against 4-4, if Oregon State wins, it's just a second win, and ooh, man, these teams weren't very good this year.
Yeah, it would be kind of just a bad loss for Wazoo. But do you think going forward, these teams will, I mean, they already don't like each other, like from the Pac-12 days, like the original Pac-12 days. Like, are they going to grow to really hate each other?
I don't think so. Because
is that a bad, should they? Shouldn't they grow to hate each other?
Think about what hate is born from. Like, I understand why Oregon and Oregon State don't like each other. I understand why Washington and Washington State don't like each other. There's not just a lot of history there. There are differences between those schools. Washington sits in Seattle. Washington State sits in Pullman. There's a inferiority complex that exists there. Washington fans look down upon Washington State. Washington State doesn't like it. They've got some history. Oregon State and Oregon probably feel the same way in recent years. It has been more about the disparity in sort of who they are and what they are and what they're about and what their brand is than anything. I think it's going to be hard for two schools that banded together out of survival to hate each other. Because, Steven, they were in it together. They're in it together now. They, you know, without each other, what do they have? They're in court together fighting against the 10 departing schools. They're banded together fighting against the Mountain West in these lawsuits. They are banded together trying to put together a schedule and trading partners. Remember, it took Oregon and Oregon State and Washington State to get, like, last season, the 2024 season, like, Boise State had to get out of the Oregon game. Oregon moved to play Oregon State. Everybody was helping each other. Texas Tech was supposed to play Oregon, ended up playing Washington State. Like, everybody was helping. There were a lot of people, they were all helping each other. If Washington State had hosed Oregon State and left them behind, Oregon State would hate them. But they're huddled together right now. There's a hurricane going on outside, and they're in the kitchen, huddled down by the kitchen sink together, you know, with a candle burning, and they're going, you know, let's get to 26.
But they got through it. They got through it to the other side, and they have, you know, they'll survive it, and now they're going to be in a conference, the same, you know, the same named conference, a different, you know, different members in there, but yeah. You're still in there. I feel like it's one of those things where, like, yes, they may end up hating each other. Like, it may come down to, you know, Oregon State plays Washington State in the final game of the year, and the winner goes to a Pac-12 championship, and then it's a real rivalry that's born. But I do think that these teams should embrace being rivals with one another and, like, being the original Pac-12 members that are still held back together. Like, embrace that and embrace the hate. You can still respect one another with all the stuff that you've gone through.
But what? I mean, I just don't know if they hate each other at this point. I think
you
got
to find someone to hate. And I mean, what? You can hate Oregon and Washington, but you're not competing with them.
Isn't Boise State the more likely school because of the success they've had? That isn't it more
but that's
likely,
like,
to be Boise State than anything?
Yeah, but that's like the Blazers that have a rivalry with the Lakers. No, Laker fans don't care about them.
Right.
Are Boise State fans really going to care about Oregon State or Washington? Boise's had success on the national level.
I feel like Boise State and Oregon State could have had a little something-something with a rivalry because they were fighting over some of the same players. And when Boise was in the Mountain West and Oregon State was in the Pac-12, they were fighting over some of the same recruits. But I think once they're on the same level, I don't know. Right now, you know, there is a little bit of a rivalry in the Mountain West between UNLV and Boise State. Oregon State and Washington State have to compete at the highest levels of the conference in order for that to happen. So what I could see happening is San Diego State, Boise State, Oregon State, and Washington State should be at the top of the new Pac-12. I could see those schools that are funding at the higher levels not liking each other over time. But it's going to take a couple of years of playing for a conference championship. Only one can go to the playoff. It's going to take some of those things and some bad feelings. And that's how you develop a
rivalry. But
that's
why with the Northwest, you already got the Northwest built in. You're the only two Northwest teams. There should be that national rivalry.
Should be. But again, you know, they're in survival mode, you know. They have a situation going on around them, and they're like clutched together, huddled together in the kitchen. The 5 at 5 is coming up. Leave it here.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Ravens-Dolphins coming up just a few minutes right here on 750 The Game. NFL Thursday Night Football. Tomorrow on the show, it'll be the BFT jury. Among other topics, we'll talk about Oregon State, Washington State, give our picks for the weekend, and World Series will be wrapped up in short order. Are you into the World Series, Stephen? Did it hook you, or has it been underwhelming for you after the Mariners got knocked out?
No, I think it's been a fun World Series for sure. I think the Game 3 18-inning battle really made it that much more interesting. Because after the Dodgers split the first two in Toronto, I kind of thought, all right, this series might be over. And then the Dodgers win the 18-inning game, and you thought, man, this is really over. But now Toronto's bounced back with those two in a row, and it really feels like this might be Toronto, the team of destiny now. So, yeah, I'm in. And now you got Yamamoto on the mound tomorrow. Like, he's been unbelievable in the playoffs, in the postseason. So, yeah, I'm into the World Series this year.
Are the Dodgers a good bet at 2-1 right now? They got to win two games.
I think so. I think so because I think with Yamamoto on in game six.
So you're thinking there's going to be a game
I'm
seven.
Thinking there's going to be a game seven. So then you have the Dodgers at plus 200 to win
that'd be a value bet.
Very much so.
So there it is. There's the bet of the day. In case Chauncey's listening.
I heard it straight from Terry Rozier. I mean,
come on. All right. You didn't answer the question, though. Do you think there's more at stake with the Oregon State-Washington State game, or do you think won't deliver because...
No, I think you're right. I was playing a little devil's advocate. I think I wish there was more of a rivalry between the two schools, but I feel like they've been kind of the little brother to Washington and Oregon for so long that they've always kind of banded together on that. Even in the old world Pac-12, they kind of, you know, felt each other's pain. And so when all of it came down and the Pac-12's crumbling, they stuck together. So I wish it felt like it was more, but I don't feel like this is a real rivalry. I feel like these are like two allies that are playing against each other and, you know, holding the flags together.
Yeah, they're in it together. And so, you know, how can they be against each other?
Yeah, they were bonded by this.
They were bonded. I think the bigger thing that could happen is they go to the 2026 season and it's Oregon State, Washington State trying to prove that they should be the conference champion and San Diego State and Boise State trying to take that flag and that mantle from them. I think that's the more likely scenario in 26 because those schools are going to fund. Oregon State, Washington State better get busy spending money. We got the 5 at 5. Steven's got the best 5 stories. Let's see how it goes.
The 5 at 5. Number 1.
Well, speaking of spending money in college football, Nebraska, they are going to be ponying up some dough as they have signed a 2-year contract extension with their head coach, Matt Rhule. This morning they did that. Now this contract will take Rhule through the 2032 season. It includes a $15 million buyout this year that effectively eliminates him from any jobs in the coaching cycle. Of course, Rhule was rumored to be a Penn State guy, as he did go to Penn State. He was rumored to go there, but it looks like he will be staying in Nebraska. Now, Nebraska is 6-2 on this season so far. Matt Rhule has been there for a couple years. Funny thing, though, about Matt Rhule, and I like Matt Rhule as a coach. I think he's pretty good, but I found this stat very interesting, John. He is a combined 0-18 against AP-ranked opponents at Baylor and Nebraska. So he's never beaten a ranked opponent while at Nebraska or Baylor, but just got a 2-year extension and a ton of money to stay in Nebraska. The world of college football is a strange one.
Is this like, he's like James Franklin. Does this change how you feel maybe about the USC-Nebraska game? You know, I had a hard time handicapping that game. USC is going to Nebraska. Lincoln Riley has not won a meaningful road game.
Ever.
Maybe ever, but it's certainly not this season. Two Big Ten losses, excuse me, on the road. They're going to Nebraska. USC's a 6-point favorite. I picked USC to win, Steven, but I don't feel great about it.
He's certainly never won a game where he's had to travel two time zones at USC.
I picked USC, but I picked it USC close. Like, I don't think they cover the 6. What do you think?
Yeah, if it's gun to my head, I'd pick USC to win, but Nebraska to cover.
That's the pick. Moving on to number 2 on your list.
Number 2.
Also, speaking of the World Series, as we talked about earlier, Blue Jays manager John Schneider told reporters today that they are expected to have leadoff hitter George Springer back for Game 6. Of course, Springer missed Games 4 and 5 while recovering from an injury to his side, which he hurt in Game 3 in that 18-inning marathon. But Schneider said that he's checked every box physically so far, and he is hoping and expecting George Springer to be in the lineup tomorrow night up in Toronto, 5 p.m. first pitch, where the Blue Jays could win their first World Series since Joe Carter back in, 1991? That'll be Yamamoto versus Gausman. Game 6 in the clincher for the Blue Jays, but expect George Springer back for Toronto, who's already, their offense is already kind of cooking.
They don't need him. Do they need him?
Yeah, dude, you need George Springer. He's a clutch
hitter.
You could always use a guy like George Springer who's going to get clutch hits for you.
Yeah, look, they've been so good. Their offense 1-9 and their lineup 1-9, so good. You forget he's not there at times because they mash. And the Blue Jays are flying in the face of one of the biggest axioms of baseball, in that pitching overcomes hitting. Good pitching overcomes hitting. The Dodgers have good pitching. the Blue Jays are winning this series 3-2. I think the Ohtani performance on the mound is looming large for the Dodgers, of course. But I agree with you. I think it's going seven. I don't know who wins a game seven in Toronto, but I think it's going seven. I think that this is going to be a fun series to see how it completes over the weekend.
Number three.
Well, sports gambling controversy has headed through all sports ever since the gambling scandal. Now the NCAA, they are part of it as well. They announced today that they will implement player availability reports for the 2026 men's and women's basketball tournament in March for the March Madness NCAA tournaments. Teams now must submit their availability reports to the NCAA the night before their games, and then again 2 hours before tip-off, according to a news release. And these reports will be made available to the public. Players will be assumed to be available unless designated as questionable or out, according to the release, and inaccurate reporting may result in penalties for the school. Of course, this is all gambling-related, John, and for the 2025 tournament, men's and women's, the American Gaming Association estimated that Americans would legally wager approximately $3.1 billion for the NCAA tournaments, men's and women's. So this is why they are putting out the availability reports.
March Madness tournaments will have a pregame injury report. Tommy Lloyd at Arizona says he's against this. Some other coaches have come out against it. You know, again, they're selling all the way out to the gaming industry here. But they're going to justify it. They're going to try to justify it and rationalize it by saying, hey, this gives us a chance to monitor this stuff even better. Rolling my eyes.
Number four.
How about this? Portland State basketball getting some good news today as ESPN announced they will be adding the February 19th Portland State game versus Idaho to ESPNU on national TV. The Vikings are going to host the Vandals in that Big Sky Conference game. This game will be played at Portland State, and the game initially was scheduled for ESPN+. It'll now be on the ESPNU platform. And Portland State, of course, they are projected. They were preseason number two in the Big Sky this season, while the Idaho, they are preseason number four. So actually a big Sky game right there. Portland State games have always been or have been live streamed on ESPN Plus in the past season, but this will be the first nationally televised basketball game at Viking Pavilion since it opened in 2018. The last nationally televised game for Portland State was back in 2009 when they took on Boise State. They actually won that game, but that was at the Stott Center. So this is the first nationally televised game for Portland State at Viking Pavilion. Pretty cool. And Jace Coburn's got a squad, so you know, a chance to get on national TV, maybe beat Idaho, and get yourself ranked higher up in the Big Sky.
Yeah, look, Jace Coburn's got a really good team, and they're going to be fun. And it's going to be interesting to kind of compare and contrast what's going on in football at Portland State with what's going on in basketball at Portland State. And then ask yourself, where should they be committing their dollars? I've been outspoken saying, hey, the football team needs more help. The football team needs more help. If the basketball team makes hay and Jace Coburn gets to the NCAA tournament, and that makes millions of dollars for the Big Sky Conference, and by extension, millions of dollars for Portland State, an argument could be made. Are they spending their money wisely by going into basketball?
Number five.
And the Ravens are taking on the Dolphins in Thursday night football down in Miami. And big news for the Ravens, Lamar Jackson, the quarterback, is back tonight for Baltimore, who was 2-5 on the season. But they're still the favorite to win the AFC North. So the Ravens need to get some dubs. Lamar Jackson back. Should be an exciting game down in South Beach.
No ping pong tables in the clubhouse or the locker
room.
No fun at all for the Ravens. See how they take care of business. All right, we're back tomorrow with another great show. You can find me at johnconzano.com. I have my picks for the week up there now, plus a whole bunch of other good stuff. Hope you read me there. Get a free subscription or a paid subscription, whatever works for you, works for me. And grab a podcast of the show wherever you get it. The Bald-Faced Truth, not here for a long time, just a good time. Thank you to Steven. Thank you to Judah. Thank you to Noah. Thank you to Fletch and Perk and everybody helping behind the scenes today.